Good afternoon, listeners. This is the Dogs Program on 3CR. We're here to promote and to defend public education. And because we believe that all children should be given an education without fear or favour, with no entrance requirements, we also believe in the separation of religion from the state. We all know that both of these things, public education and separation of religion from the state, are under tremendous pressure at the moment in both Australia and also in other parts of the world. So our press release 1049, which Andy's bringing to us, takes us over to America to get the latest. Over to Andy.
Thanks, Jane. And this is press release number 1049, The Importance of Separation of Religion from the State in Public Education, Current American Experience. Dogs support public education, which is free, universal, and secular, because this is the only way that children of our democratic nation can be educated in schools that are open to all and offensive to none. This is also why Dogs support the separation of religion from the state and state aid for state schools only. When religious people attempt to legislate who can be taught, what can be taught, and who can teach, you have a situation like that in Trump's America. Christian nationalists in that country, a nation which pioneered a separation of religion from the state, have been instrumental in the banning of books and are still arguing about the teaching of evolution. Book banning in the USA. The US Department of Defense, DOD, has been forced to release a list of 596 books it is seeking to ban in schools it operates in seven states, Guam, Puerto Rico, and 11 countries. The move came in response to a lawsuit filed by the American Civil Liberties Union on behalf of military families who oppose the censorship crusade. According to the site Book Riot, these schools, run by the Department of Defense Education Activity, serve approximately 67,000 children of military families worldwide. LGBTQ plus titles targeted. Not surprisingly, many of the titles on the list deal with LGBTQ plus issues. Some of them, such as Maya Kababi's Genderqueer, have been in Christian nationalist crosshairs for years. Others appear to have been added because they have terms like LGBTQ, transgender, trans, equality, and diversity in their titles. Still others are about race or sexual health, and oddly, some are even study guides for advanced placement tests. It's unclear who pulled the list together, but Book Riot noted that the list has some similarities to one drawn up in 2021 by Matt Krause, a former member of the Texas House of Representatives. Krause had demanded that titles on it be removed from public libraries in the state. Trump EOs require censorship. The DOD's list came about in response to a series of executive orders issued by President Donald Trump that purport to oppose gender ideology extremism and radical indoctrination in federally funded programs. One order specifically targeted the military. Shortly after the orders were issued, officials at the Department of Defense directed staff at department-run schools to ensure books potentially related to gender ideology or discriminatory equity ideology are removed from the student section. Many military families were outraged by the censorship and challenged the book banning in court. The history of teaching of evolution in the USA. There is a long history of controversy in the teaching of evolution theory in the US. 100 years ago, the famous Scopes monkey trial in Dayton, Tennessee, had just concluded. A teacher, John T. Scopes, was found guilty of teaching evolution on July 21, 1925, and fined $100. 5 days after the trial, William Jennings Bryan, the populist orator and fundamentalist Christian who assisted with the state's case, died in his sleep. The culmination of the case was a bit anticlimactic. There was an appeal, and in January of 1927, the Tennessee Supreme Court voided Scopes' verdict on a technicality. The court ruled that Scopes' fine should have been determined by the jury, not the judge who presided over the trial, even as it upheld the state's anti-evolution law. The Tennessee High Court seemed to be happy to be shed of the legal tussle, asserting, "Nothing is to be gained by prolonging the life of this bizarre case." It would be nice to say that 100 years later, we've put all this behind us and reached a consensus. And by some metrics, things are moving in that direction. A recent poll showed that fewer than 20% of Americans back the creationist view that humans have existed in their present form since the beginning of time. 33% of Americans say they believe humans have evolved over time due to natural selection, with God playing no role. The largest number, 47%, back what would be called theistic evolution, the idea that humans evolved over time in a process that was guided by God. But culture wars still rage. Despite findings like these, the teaching of evolution remains contentious in some parts of the country, and various anti-evolution proposals continue to surface in state legislatures. With the Supreme Court eroding church-state precedents, this is not a time to be complacent. As Glenn Branch, Deputy Director of the National Centre for Science Education, said recently, on the one hand, evolution education is increasing and improving overall, and the chance that a local teacher is espousing a creationism in the classroom is dwindling. On the other hand, in light of the upheaval in church-state jurisprudence, it is entirely possible that the foes of evolution education will redouble their efforts in the hopes of making up lost ground. Branch concluded, now more than ever, eternal vigilance on the part of the friends of evolution education is in order. An endless battle. That's often the case with church-state issues. We have to fight them over and over, always alert to new tactics from Christian nationalists who yearn to turn the state into an enforcer of their theology. The events in Daytona, Tennessee, that steamy summer 100 years ago, were the beginning, not the end, of a long culture war over science education in America's public schools. Christian nationalists aren't quite done trying to monkey with the First Amendment just yet. The tactics of those who wish to be enforcers of the national conscience, usually at taxpayers' expense, keep evolving. Those like dogs who wish to separate religion and the state must remain diligent. They certainly must. Back to you, Jean.
Thank you, Andy. And now let's come back to Australia, where the Rationalist Society of Australia is very concerned about the lack of reporting, really, or just oversight, here in Australia on the federally funded school chaplaincy policy. As we all know, chaplains are replacing counsellors in some schools. Over to you again, Andy.
Thanks, Jean. Inadequate reporting process masking discrimination in federally funded school chaplaincy roles, says Rationalist Society of Australia. This was written by Cy Gladman and published on the 9th of August. The Federal Education Department is masking ongoing religious-based discrimination in chaplaincy roles in the National Student Wellbeing Program, NSWP, through inadequate reporting processes, says the Rationalist Society of Australia. Documents obtained under Freedom of Information, FOI, laws show that the states and territories are required to simply mark yes or no or Y or N to the question of whether student wellbeing officers and chaplains employed in the NSWP were of any faith or of no faith. In the annual checklist of annual reporting for 2023, all states and territories confirmed that the program met this requirement, along with the requirements that wellbeing officers and chaplains respected, accepted, and were sensitive to other people's views, values, and beliefs, and did not proselytise. In the 2024 reporting year, the three states that had submitted by the time of the RSA's request for documents earlier this year had also indicated that the program met these requirements. However, as the RSA has continually pointed out, religious-based discrimination remains a central feature of the $61 million per year NSWP, with the chaplains employed in schools under the program being required to meet religious credentials. Last month, the RSA, supported by eight other non-religious, ex-religious and pro-secular organisations, detailed the discriminatory nature of the NSWP in a submission to the United Nations Human Rights Council Universal Periodic Review into Australia's human rights. It was one example of discrimination and unfair treatment against non-religious people in government institutions and programs. The submission said the federally funded program discriminated on the grounds of religion and belief as the employment of chaplains via third-party religious labour hire firms required candidates have religious credentials such as ordination, an active church life, and endorsement by a religious institution. The NSWP funding agreement says the program is explicitly not religious and that wellbeing officers and chaplains may be of any faith or of no faith. Yet, in response to questions from secular advocates in 2023, the Federal Education Department stated that the chaplaincy roles were distinguished by the need for chaplains to confirm their faith. A spokesperson for the Education Department also said that a worker's religion had nothing to do with the work they do, and that secular wellbeing officers and chaplains provide the same services in schools. The RSA's submission to the UN Human Rights Council last month also argued that the NSWP program was discriminatory in failing to cater for non-religious students and families, as the religious nature of chaplaincy roles erected barriers to some people in seeking care. After releasing the documents under FOI to the RSA, the Federal Education Department also published them on its website. Speaking today, RSA Executive Director Cy Gladman said the annual reporting by states and territories appeared to be a tick and flick exercise aimed at avoiding any serious review of the NSWP. The reality is that a large number of these NSWP roles that are funded by taxpayers require that people hired be people of faith. The Albanese government, with this inadequate reporting process, is masking from the public the religious-based discrimination that is a defining feature of the NSWP, he said. The NSWP, formerly the National School Chaplaincy Program, has long been dogged by allegations of chaplains using their access to children in public schools to proselytise. In 2022, an evaluation report of the program highlighted testimonials from students that chaplains had tried to push their religion, had attempted to discuss religion with me, and promoted off-site religious activities. In June this year, the RSA revealed that the chaplaincy and pastoral care teams of many religious schools that receive millions of public funding under the NSWP were performing religious activities such as leading Bible studies, conducting chapel services, providing spiritual support, and running prayer and devotional sessions. Certainly not what we want in free secular education for all. Back to you, Jean.
Let's have a quick break, shall we?
Are you a 3CR subscriber?
We really need our listeners to subscribe to the station.
Call 03-9419 8377 or sign up online at 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
Well, we hope you're still listening to the Dogs program because we've got a very full program and an interesting one. Back to Australia, and Chris Bonner from Save Our Schools is writing on Inside Story, and he has a very interesting article on lessons for Australian schooling from overseas. Over to Sorrel.
Thanks, Jean. This article was written by Chris Bonner and is entitled Lessons for Australian Schooling. Successful overseas systems are no panacea for Australia's problems, but they can help us think more clearly about the options. Less than a year ago, a little band of educators travelled to Canada to investigate why that country always seems to be ahead of Australia in the school achievement and equity stakes. The travellers agreed that it is time for different, more open, where to from now conversations about Australia's schools. Their detailed report, including findings and recommendations, is now available. To encourage new approaches, the travellers linked with two very different organisations. Ellen Koshland's Australian Learning Lecture, a refreshingly different social reform think tank, and leading educators around the planet, which has long helped school leaders see best practice up close and bring it back to our schools. Both organisations and the travellers share a concern about the direction being taken by Australian school education. They have good reason to worry. The differences between schools above and below the average index of socio-educational advantage, or ICSA, are becoming very noticeable. The above schools with an index of 1,000 or more are getting bigger and monopolising the headlines about school achievement. The below schools, 1,000 or less, are far less sought after and publicised. Public schools are enrolling more of the most disadvantaged. The drift of families who have choice has become a scramble from low to high ICSEA schools in all sectors, government, Catholic, and independent. Overall, NAPLAN scores have changed little over time, but they have markedly fallen in the below schools. A study of the link between student school ICSEA and NAPLAN achievement
shows that family background, ahead of what schools and teachers do, has an increasing grip on student achievement. On equity grounds alone, it is a dismal picture for a country that prides itself on a fair go for all. In searching for solutions, it helps to know some of the background, how the problems evolved, how they feed off each other, and why intervention is needed. Until recently, school funding has been the highest profile issue. The Gonski recommendations about school resourcing didn't fare well under changing governments and endless fiddling, including by the states and territories. Federal Labor has restored a pathway to full funding of public schools, but the rollout is delayed, and we'll have to hope that history won't repeat itself. But even if the funding does arrive, decisions made in the past will still act as a drag on both equity and achievement. Dean Ashenden told the whole sorry story recently in Inside Story. Researcher Barbara Preston has shown how the very unlevel school playing field still firmly in place has affected schools. In Choice and Fairness, a Common Framework for All Australian Schools, Australian Learning Lecture confirms the problems but also points to a solution. What is really wrong with Australia's schools, and why do we need to search high and low, at home and abroad, for solutions? The most noticeable indicator is enrolment segregation and its impact far and wide. At the level of schools and families, Australia's segregating school framework is seemingly locked into a vicious cycle. At stage one, schools have unequal obligations, operation, resources, and outcomes. Some must be open to all, others charge fees or set entrance tests. The result? We are concentrating achievers and strugglers at different schools. Stage two. This creates less diversity within schools and more social and achievement gaps between them. And despite the effort of teachers, the impact of each student's peers, more so than teachers, increasingly impacts on outcomes. At stage three, there are consequent gains for some students and schools, losses for others, and lower overall student achievement. Well-placed schools increasingly build on their advantage by competing for preferred students. Stage four, this further increases the differences between schools in image, presentation, achievements, and challenges, not helped by a narrowing of the purpose of schools, the measurables of success, and resulting league tables. Stage five, choice decisions by families able to choose further drive enrollments toward the more advantaged schools in all sectors. The accumulating effect of this further tilts the school competition playing field in favour of those schools. This regressive sequence plays out in just about every Australian community and pervades conversations about schools, teachers, and in the better resourced families, school choice. Even casual observers can see the links between the stages in the cycle and how schools fare in what has become a very lopsided competition. It looks like a system designed to create winners and losers. Many of these problems, along with the half-hearted solutions, have found their way into official reports. These include a 2023 Productivity Commission report on the National School Reform Agreement and a review commissioned the same year by Jason Clare to inform a better and fairer education system. The latter's report is essential reading. It argues that the growing segregation of school enrolments needs to be tackled not least because of the extent of segregation is making it less likely that other reforms will achieve Australia's long-standing ambition of equity and excellence. The other feature of this regressive cycle is that it is fueled by assumptions about school quality. Dean Ashenden's book, Unbeaching the Whale, points the finger at Labor's education revolution and how successive governments have insisted that schools serve a narrowing range of priorities, reinforced by measurable student outcomes. It is hardly surprising that families at stage 4 and 5 of the cycle become very fussy about their preferred school. The persistence of the cycle not only undermines both equity and excellence, but also raises questions about efficiency and effectiveness. There have been no gains in the winning schools to balance the losses elsewhere. It advantages some families in relative terms, albeit at a dollar cost to them, and imposes an opportunity cost on others. And all this is taking place alongside the ever-present human cost of lost livelihoods and disconnected young people, families, and communities. School reform is a busy response to all this, but doesn't deal with the fundamentals of the cycle. The most common interventions have tried to improve inputs, funding, for example, near the top of the cycle or close the gaps between schools at stage 2 by reforming classroom and social practice. But it hasn't worked. And we are still left with a wicked problem wrapped in a vicious circle. Few reformers want to touch an unlevel playing field that requires only public schools to be free and inclusive. The dimensions of the problem are harder to avoid. Browbeaten by growing concern, the 2023 review even commissioned research on how to make schools more socio-educationally diverse and ensure affluent and non-affluent students don't grow up strangers to each other. More recently, a former education system head, Michelle Bruniges, gathered, assessed, and reported on new ideas to reduce concentrated disadvantage in our schools and ways to improve equity across them. It is certainly possible to intervene at different stages to diversify enrollments within schools. Bruniges suggested adjusting school zoning to challenge the way postcodes concentrate both wealth and disadvantage. Michael Skiffer, one of the Australian team in Canada, shows how this can be done. Stage 2 in the cycle would start to look different if public funding substantially rewarded schools for enrolling more students from targeted disadvantaged groups. The problem is that solutions grafted onto a largely dysfunctional framework might not be resilient enough to fend off efforts to unwind even the most thoughtful interventions. In Canada, the Australian team found evidence of creeping compromises that worsened the prospects of equity and achievement. One Canadian province allowed many community schools to become selective. Another loosened the regulations around school choice of public schools. This suggests the need for a more holistic approach. Bruniges certainly stressed that we must rethink how we resource and structure our education system. The Australian Secondary Principals Association has a new focus on transforming systems, declared that inconsistency and inequity in the way schools are regulated must be tackled. It is effectively calling for a new schooling accord with a common funding and regulatory framework to enable all schools to tackle entrenched inequities. The Australian excursion to Canada and its newly released report has the potential to inform these conversations by clarifying what might be gold standard policy options while gently dismissing ideas that won't make enough difference in the Australian context. Lessons from Canada, an equal school system is possible, asks if there is a better way to design our school system. After all, Canada and Australia are similar societies with different educational outcomes. The report makes 8 significant findings derived from a close look at 3 quite different provinces. It concludes that solutions are possible and outlines the steps towards a more equal school system. One province started diversifying its provision of schools in the 1970s, the same decade in which Australia unwittingly launched what became our regressive cycle. This particular Canadian province put in regulations and conditions that have generally stood the test of time, to the point where the province has achieved a reasonable public-private balance in the provision and operation of schools. The reader might ask why we don't do the same. Some of the regulations and conditions, if implemented in Australia, would improve our framework of schools, but they would fall short of an optimum solution. We can do better. We could identify strongly with another province, but for all the wrong reasons. Just like Australia, this province has stumbled into serious equity problems. Quite uniquely in Canada, it substantially funds private schools. But as equity problems grew, it then allowed many public schools to become selective. It could be argued that Australia and this province are competing in a race to the bottom. There is, however, one important difference. A parent-driven organisation in that province has come up with a plan for a common school network that has shifted public opinion and been drafted into possible legislation. Watch this space. In common with a number of countries, a third province already has a fully funded framework of schools, with both secular and Catholic schools operating under almost identical obligations and responsibilities. All schools are resourced according to need, and they are regulated on a consistent basis, but they are diverse in character, curriculum, ethos, and governance. No school, including Catholic schools, is allowed to charge fees, and fee-charging schools are only found in the small private sector. Variations of this approach are found in other Canadian provinces. Smart educators know that it isn't easy or even necessary to transplant school system reforms from one place to another. But Australia has done worse than that. Our response has been to shut our minds to the world beyond the level of each school. It's not working. It is time we swallow our pride, take the blinkers off, and learn from those who just might be doing better. Back over to you, Jean.
Many thanks, Sorrel. We know it was a long one, but it was a good one, wasn't it? And now we have a short one from Andy. The teachers and public school advocates here in Victoria, in Melbourne, are not happy with the Labor government, who have cut funding to public schooling. So on the 4th of August, they had a rally. Over to Andy.
Thanks, Jean. And this is a press release from the Victorian branch of the Australian Education Union. Victorian public school staff representatives rallied outside Parliament House on the 4th of August, demanding the Allan Labor government put Victorian students first and reverse the $2.4 billion cut in public school funding. Australian Education Union Victorian branch president Justin Mullaly said the Premier had broken her promise to fully fund public schools after deciding in April 2024 to cut $2.4 billion. The Premier made a promise in January this year to deliver 100% of the schooling resource standard to public schools, but what she didn't tell Victorians was that she had no intention of delivering on that promise in a meaningful way, Mr. Mullaly said. In April 2024, the state government had already decided not to deliver any additional funding until 2031, meaning at least $2.4 billion would not be allocated to our schools. This funding would enable schools to better meet the diverse needs of all students, ensure improved learning outcomes, and guarantee that every student in every classroom has a fully qualified permanent teacher. Chronic workforce shortages are leaving students without the support they require, with too many missing out on one-on-one assistance, especially those who need extra support. Right now, Victorian public schools are the lowest funded in Australia, and every school in the state is affected. That means the learning and well-being of every student is impacted. Victorian teachers are the lowest paid in the country, with education support staff and school leaders undervalued. Not recognising the worth of school staff goes hand in hand with the underfunding of our schools. The Premier needs to reverse this funding cut. Our students, their families and the profession demands it, Mr. Mullaly said. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you very much for all that our people are doing for us. But we now go to a quick break and then international news.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio 855 AM on digital and online. 3CR Radical Radio.
3CR. We hope you're still with us here on the Dogs program because now Jeff is going to take us overseas.
Good afternoon, listeners. As you're well aware, the Trump administration has shown itself to be a full-fledged authoritarian regime. Most of these are from the Diana Ravitch blog. I encourage you to read it. First article, this one's by John Thompson, an immigrant children in Oklahoma live in fear. John Thompson, historian and retired teacher in Oklahoma, writes about the cloud of fear that has settled over the schools as children of immigrant families fear harm to themselves and their families. Teachers in other districts have reported that the children of immigrant families are not showing up for school. They're afraid that the masked gunmen of ICE might suddenly appear to take them away. School is no longer a safe place. He writes, Oklahoma schools find themselves in a challenging position, suddenly caught in the middle of the Trump administration's push to deport illegal immigrants. Schools have found themselves at the forefront of immigration debates before, but this feels different. They face so many more challenges, ranging from the threat of US immigration and customs enforcement raids to decreasing attendance rates as families choose to keep their family home to avoid the trauma associated with them. The Trump administration has withheld funding for school programs, including migrant education and services for English language learners. And State and Superintendent Ryan Walters' policies, such as trying to require schools to collect data on immigration status of students, are further destabilizing our education system. This isn't the first time I've attended OK Justice Circles, Breaking Bread panel and group discussions. This panel has met 14 times since 2020 in order to increase community awareness of the lived experiences of racial and ethnic minorities in Oklahoma City area. The latest Breaking Bread topic, which focused on the harm state and federal policies are causing to our state's Hispanic community, was the most emotional one I've ever attended during the last 5 years. For instance, as a panelist was leaving for the conference, a student told her that she is studying the Holocaust and could see parallels forming between that horrific event that ultimately resulted in the deaths of 6 million Jewish people and ramping up our country's immigration enforcement efforts. An elected school board member who represents a majority Hispanic district reported receiving death threats. Another urban district reported seeing an alarming surge in absenteeism. I heard stories about how students now come to school every day with their birth certificates in their backpacks just in case ICE raids their schools. I can't remember the last time a child had to prove they were an American citizen while at school. These raised tough questions about what schools can do to protect the students they're entrusted to serve. Schools cannot politicise the issues they deal with, but they can help provide wraparound services like increased access to food and solutions to housing insecurity. They also address the physical and mental health issues that their students are experiencing, and they can refer to students to non-profit and public agencies that have support structures. But those solutions require trust in the law and procedures that ICE agents are required to follow. It is really difficult to trust the immigration enforcement process right now. The Trump administration held funding for English language services. I worry that federal leaders could one day try to take it even a step further by denying access to public school to undocumented children. That would inflict incredible hardships on families and untold amounts of damage on our state's social and economic future. Fortunately, Representative Arturo Alonso Sandoval, Democrat of Oklahoma City, gave me some reason for hope. Over 20 anti-immigration bills were introduced to the legislature this year, but only one became law. Only time will tell if the majority of Oklahomans can find the courage to push back on the policies that are causing immeasurable harm to our Hispanic neighbours. I often find myself wondering, what would it say about Oklahomans and our integrity if we did not stand up and reject today's cruelty? This article, Thomas Friedman, The World We Knew It As Rapidly Slipping Away, Dinarevich writes as an introduction. Thomas Friedman writes a regular comment in the New York Times. This one is unusually perspicacious. I was deeply moved by its candour, and I agree with him. Trump and his enablers are turning the presidency into a monarchy, giving him more power than any president ever had and more power than the founders imagined. Checks and balances have been wiped out. The Supreme Court's right-wing majority approves all of his power grabs. He is imposing heavy fines on universities without regard to basic principles of academic freedom. He has made it criminal to support policies that advance diversity, equity, and inclusion. He is waging war on science. He is forcing the news media to pay him tribute. He fires veteran data scientists unless they report good news. In his first term, his most notable achievement was the funding of Operation Warp Speed, which invested in the rapid production of mRNA vaccines. These vaccines dramatically reduced COVID, which killed 1 million people in the US. Yet, just days ago, Trump's health secretary, RFK Jr., cancelled $500 million in research grants for vaccines. RFK further killed development of Trump's greatest triumph. When asked about it at a press conference, Trump took pride in what RFK was doing. Did he understand the question? His actions are unprecedented. They are actions of a dictator. Thomas Friedman begins, "Of all the terrible things Donald Trump has said and done as president, the most dangerous one just happened on Friday. Trump, in effect, ordered our trusted and independent government Office of Economic Statistics to become as big a liar as he is. He fired Erica McEntafa, the Senate-confirmed head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, for bringing him economic news he did not like. And in the hours immediately following, the second most dangerous thing happened. The senior Trump officials most responsible for running our economy, people who in their private businesses never would have contemplated firing a subordinate who brought them financial data they did not like, all went along for the ride. What they should have said to Trump is this: Mr. President, if you don't reconsider this decision, if you fire the top Labor Bureau statistician because she brought you bad economic news, how will anyone in the future trust that office when it issues good news? Instead, they immediately covered for him. As the Wall Street Journal pointed out, Labor Secretary Lori Chavez de Rema had actually gone on Bloomberg TV Friday and declared that even though the jobs report that had just been released was revised downward for May and June, we've seen positive job growth. But as soon as she got the news hours later that Trump had fired the very BLS director who reports to her, she wrote on X, "I agree wholeheartedly with POTUS that our jobs numbers must be fair, accurate, and never manipulated for political purposes." As the Journal asked, "So were the jobs data that were positive in the morning rigged by the afternoon?" Of course not. The moment I heard what Trump had done, I had a flashback. It was January 2021, and I had just been reported that Trump, after losing the 2020 election, had tried to pressure Georgia's Republican Secretary of State to find him enough votes, exactly 11,780, Trump said, to overturn the presidential election, and even threatened him with a criminal offence if he didn't. The pressure came during an hour-long telephone call, according to an audio recording of the conversation. The difference, though, is that back then there was something called a Republican official with integrity. And so Georgia's Secretary of State did not agree to fabricate votes that did not exist, but that species of Republican official seems to have gone completely extinct in Trump's second term. So Trump's rotten character is now a problem for our whole economy. Going forward, how many government bureaucrats are going to dare to pass along bad news when they know that their bosses, people like Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, the Director of National Economic Council, Kevin Hassett, Labor Secretary Chavez de Rema, and the US Trade Representative, Jamison Greer, will not only fail to defend them, but will actually offer them up as a sacrifice to Trump to keep their jobs? Shame on each and every one of them, particularly on Bessent, a former hedge fund manager who knows better and did not step in. What a coward. As Bessent's predecessor, Janet Yellen, former Treasury Secretary, and also the former chair of the Federal Reserve, and a person with actual integrity, told my Times colleague Ben Castleman of the BLS firing, this is the kind of thing you would only expect to see in a banana republic. It's important to know how foreigners are looking at this. Bill Blaine, a London-based bond trader who publishes a newsletter popular amongst market experts called Blaine's Morning Porridge, wrote on Monday, Friday, August the 1st, might go down in history as the day the US Treasury market died. There was an art to reading the US data. It relied on trust. Now that is broken. If you can't trust the data, what can you trust? He then went on to imagine how his Porridge newsletter will sound in May 2031. It will begin, he wrote, with a link to a release from Trump's Ministry of Economic Truth, formerly the US Secretary, Treasury. Under the leadership of President Trump, the US economy continues to grow at record speed. Payrolls data from the Ministry of Truth, a subsidiary of Truth Social, show full employment across America. Tensions in the inner cities have never been so low. All recent graduates have found highly paid jobs across America's expanding manufacturing sector, causing many large companies in Trump Inc. to report significant labour shortages. If you think this is far-fetched, you clearly have not been following the foreign policy news, because this kind of tactic, the tailoring of information to fit Trump's political needs, has already been deployed in the intelligence field. In May, the Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, fired two top intelligence officials who oversaw an assessment that contradicted Trump's assertions that the gang Tren de Aragua was operating under the direction of the Venezuelan regime. Their assessment undermined the dubious legal rationale Trump invoked, the rarely used 1798 Alien Enemies Act, to allow the suspected gang members to be thrown out of the country without due process. And now this trend towards self-blinding is spreading to further corners of the government. One of America's premier cyber warriors, Jen Easterly, who was the director of the Cyber Security and Infrastructure Security Agency during the Biden administration, had her appointment to a senior teaching position at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point revoked last week by Army Secretary Daniel Driscoll after Laura Loomer, a far-right conspiracy theorist, posted that Easterly was a Biden-era mole. Read that sentence again very slowly. The Army Secretary, acting on the guidance of a loony Trump acolyte, revoked the teaching appointment of, anyone will tell you, one of America's most skilled nonpartisan cyber warriors, herself a graduate of West Point. And when you're done reading that, read Easterly's response on LinkedIn. As a lifelong independent, I've served our nation in peacetime and combat under Republican and Democratic administrations. I've led missions at home and abroad to protect all Americans from vicious terrorists. I've worked my entire career not as a partisan, but as a patriot, not in pursuit of power, but in the service to the country I love and in the loyalty of the Constitution I swore to protect and defend against all enemies. And then she added this advice to the young West Pointers. She will not have the honour of teaching. Every member of the long grey line knows the cadet prayer. It asks that we choose the harder right instead of the easier wrong. That line, so simple yet so powerful, has been my North Star for more than three decades. In boardrooms and war rooms, in quiet moments and doubt and public acts of leadership, the harder right is never easy. That's the whole point. That is the woman Trump did not want teaching our next generation of fighters. And that ethic, always choose the harder right instead of the easier wrong, is the ethic that Besant, Hassett, Chevers, DeRima and Greer know nothing of, not to mention Trump himself. That's why, dear reader, though I am a congenital optimist, for the first time I believe that if the behaviour that this administration has exhibited in just its first 6 months continues and is amplified for its full 4 years, the America you know will be gone. And I don't know how we will get it back. I'm going to briefly touch on this article. This is by Jennifer Frey. She wrote, "College students are eager to engage in the liberal arts." She wrote in the New York Times, "University students, we're told, are in crisis. Even at our most elite institutions, they have emaciated attention spans. They can't or just won't read books. They use artificial intelligence to write their essays. They lack resilience and are beset by mental health crises. They complain that they can't speak their minds, hobbled by an oppressive ideological monoculture and censorship regime. As a philosopher, I am most distressed by the reports that students have no appetite to study the traditional liberal arts. They understand their coursework only as a step towards specific careers. Over the past 2 years as the inaugural dean of the University of Tulsa's Honors College, focused on studying the classic texts of the Western tradition, I've seen little evidence of these trends. The curriculum I helped build and teach required students to read thousands of pages of difficult material every semester, decipher historical texts across disciplines and genres and debate ideas vigorously and civilly in small Socratic seminars. It was tremendously popular among students, who not only do the reading but also engage in the rigorous and lively conversations across deep differences in seminars, hallways and dorms. For the past 2 years, we attracted over a quarter of each freshman class to this reading-heavy, humanities-focused curriculum. An unpleasant truth has emerged in Tulsa over the years. It's not that traditional liberal learning is out of step with student demand. Instead, it's out of step with priorities, values and desires of the powerful board of trustees with no apparent commitment to liberal education, and an administrative class that won't fight for the liberal arts even when it attracts both students and major financial gifts. The tragedy of the contemporary academy is that even when traditional liberal learning clearly wins with students and donors, it loses with those in power. For those who do care to see liberal learning thrive on our campuses, the work my colleagues and I did at Tulsa should be a model. How did we do it? We created an intentional community where our students lived in the same dorm and studied the same texts, with shared wisdom, virtue and friendship as our goals. When a university education is truly rooted in the liberal arts, it can cultivate the interior habits of freedom that young people need to live well. Material success alone cannot help a person who lacks the ability to form a clear, informed vision of what is true, good and beautiful. But this vision is something our students both want and need. At Tulsa, we invited our students to enter the great conversation with some of the most influential thinkers of our inherited intellectual tradition. For their 2 first years, they encountered a set of curriculum texts from Homer to Hannah Arendt. These texts were carefully chosen by an interdisciplinary faculty because they transcend their time and place in 2 senses. They influenced a broader tradition and had the potential to help our students reflect in a sustained way on what it means to be a good human being and a citizen. When students realise their own humanity is at stake in their education, they are deeply invested in it. The problem with liberal education in today's academy does not lie with our students. The real threat to liberal learning is from an administrative class that is content to offer students far less than their own humanity calls for and deserves. So that's just an academic crying out against the destruction and commodification of education in the United States. With that, I'm going to pass you back to the headquarters of the Dogs and wish you well. Cheerio.
Well, many thanks, Jeff. And, of course, productivity and commissions of inquiry and one thing and another are in the news at the moment. And the AEU, that's the Australian Education Union, have a very interesting media release on all of this.
Thanks, Jane. And this is a press release from the Federal Office of the Australian Education Union. Equitable, fully funded education, critical for Australia's productivity. And this is from the 7th of August, 2025. At the Albanese government's Tertiary Productivity Roundtable on the 7th of August, 2025, the AEU will highlight the critical role of fully funded, high-quality public education in driving national productivity and long-term economic growth. AEU Federal President Corina Haythorpe will outline a comprehensive set of recommendations focused on lifting Year 12 attainment, strengthening pathways from school to tertiary education and the workforce, and addressing deep-seated inequities in funding, outcomes and access across the education system. If the Albanese government is serious about improving productivity and ensuring no student is left behind, we must invest properly in Australia's teachers and education support staff, preschools, public schools and TAFE, Ms. Haythorpe said. We must urgently address teacher shortages and the unsustainable workloads facing the teaching profession and back Australia's teachers with the resources that they need. Every student, no matter where they live or what their background, deserves access to a full range of senior secondary academic and vocational subjects that can open up their future work pathways. An urgent reset is needed in the relationship between universities and vocational education, with recognition of TAFE's primacy role in VET delivery and an end to market-based funding models. Further, the deregulation of higher education has resulted in lower academic standards for entry into teaching and falling initial teacher education ITE completion rates. The AEU reaffirms its support for a 5-year minimum teaching qualification and a postgraduate 2-year master's degree. Governments cannot fix a teacher workforce shortage crisis by lowering the qualifications of the teaching profession. They must invest in decent pay and conditions of work to attract and retain teachers, Ms. Haythorpe said. This is clearly articulated in the UN Secretary General's high-level panel recommendations on the teaching profession, which are premised on the need to provide financing and to value and respect the teaching profession, with decent working conditions, competitive wages, teacher voice in decision-making, and opportunities for development and innovation. The AEU urges the Albanese government to consider Recommendation 5, which calls for the establishment of a national commission for the teaching profession. It is time to look at the national education architecture and make sure it is fit for the future needs of the profession and Australia's students, Ms. Haythorpe said. Free TAFE is a cornerstone of the national skills agenda, but decades of underfunding and privatisation has impacted on TAFE's capacity to meet the growing demand. Free TAFE has been transformative, but TAFE must be fully funded to succeed. That means investing in the TAFE teaching workforce and providing high-quality teaching and learning facilities at TAFE, Ms. Haythorpe said. With housing affordability a major issue for teachers across the country, the AEU supports the ACTU's call for housing reform and a fairer tax system. The lack of affordable housing is undermining living standards and quality of life for teachers, especially new graduates who often have to relocate to regional communities to begin their teaching careers. Many teachers are struggling to afford to live near their work, and we see young teachers especially facing high rents and being priced out of buying homes, Ms. Haythorpe said. We have the ludicrous situation where teachers pay a higher percentage of tax than big business and the very wealthy. Everyone should pay their fair share of tax, not dodge it by setting up schemes and manipulating loopholes. By having a fair tax system, there will be more funding available to invest in Australia's preschools, schools, TAFE and the teaching profession, Ms. Haythorpe said. There is no better investment for our nation than to invest in the public education system and support the teaching profession to do what they do best, deliver a high-quality education for students across the nation. That will produce economic benefits and productivity dividends for Australia. Back to you, Jane.
Well, this is the best part of the program now, our great state school.
Every week on the Doctor Program, we have a special segment to show a different state school is a great school.
State schools are great schools.
School of the week. State school.
School of the week.
Great state schools.
State schools.
School of the week.
School for the week here on the Dogs Program.
This week's great state school of the week is Albert Park College. And here's a statement from their website. Since opening to students in 2011 on the bulldozed foundations of a previous school, Albert Park College has created a dynamic learning and teaching environment equal to any school in the country. Our education results are equal to many of the state's most prestigious schools, with the high proportion of our students going on to attend the country's leading universities. Why? Because APC has developed an innovative and creative curriculum that supports, engages, and challenges students to pursue academic excellence. So how did it begin? In early 2010, Foundation Principal Steve Cook arrived at the school's sole campus in Danks Street and found a building devoid of furniture, staff, students and even a name, and got to work. We had a chance to create a new school that was an exemplar of education, Steve said, but the task was momentous. Our philosophy and motto, Lead, Create, Inspire, was born and guided the design of the college, its curriculum and the values that make it work. The first big job was to design and fit out learning spaces that reflect a 21st century learning style. Steve's brief to his architects was simple. Create the feeling of an art studio throughout the campus to inspire students to creative endeavour. The result is creative and open spaces furnished with bold colours, wood finishes and clever ergonomic furniture to create a mature and sophisticated learning environment. The next and most critical step for Steve was to recruit staff who shared his vision. We got really lucky here, Steve said. The location of the school, the temptation of new facilities, and the spreading excitement about what we were trying to achieve attracted a high number of exceptional applicants. Staff then began work developing a new curriculum suited to the teaching style and philosophy of Albert Park College. Aware of the accelerating pace of technological innovation and the critical role technology plays in the modern world, the staff developed an integrated online curriculum that would support every aspect of school life. Today, APC is considered a leader in the use of innovative technology in education. Technology is increasingly important in education, Steve said. Students at APC know how to use an incredible array of applications, can intrinsically learn new software, and are confident when using technology. In 2016, a significant milestone was reached when APC students sat the VCE for the first time. Their success and the success of VCE students that have followed has led to further enrolments. Now APC boasts 5 campuses, almost 200 staff and around 1,600 students. It's an incredible success story, and like all organisations that strive for excellence, the story continues. And now some facts and figures from the ACARA website. The current enrolment is 1,641 and the ICSEA value is above average at 1,125, representative of a diverse urban community. 52% of students have parents in the upper 25% of incomes. In the second quartile, we have 29% of students. In the third quartile, i.e. below 50%, 13% of students. And in the lowest quartile of parental incomes, 6% of students, with 22% speaking a language other than English and 0% Indigenous students. The finances, recurrent grants from the Australian government of $5.36 million and from the Victorian government, $19.5 million. Private fees and contributions add another $4.76 million and other private contributions, $414,000. And that works out per pupil at $18,631. The capital, $1.88 million over 3 years. And the results of the students, very creditable indeed. Back to you, Jean.
Well, congratulations to Albert Park College, which rose like a phoenix from the ashes of the Kennett period. But our time has gone, and it's up to me now to remind you of our website at www.adogs.info, and to thank Andy and Dale, our wonderful producer, and Jeff and Sorrel. But from all of us here at 3CR and the Dogs Program, it's bye for now.
I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die, says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find. I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.